This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. It's especially great to have as my guest, Dr. Mary Gina Rochford today. As regular listeners to the show, Dr. Rochford's a medical doctor and an ophthalmic surgeon, and she's the founder of the Rochford Eye Center in Berlin, Connecticut. So she's going to be on with us. We've had several questions coming in over time regarding the eyes, and we're going to be talking a lot about something we hear all the time. We're being barraged by treatment for dry eye syndrome. What is it? And is it really as common as people or advertisers will have us think? So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about sun damage to the eye and answer some of your questions. Also, earlier in the second segment of the show, we're going to have Dr. Xuan Lin talk to us. Dr. Lin is a doctor of medical dentistry. She's an assistant clinical professor of dentistry at the University of Connecticut. And I decided to go to an expert to talk about none other than the idea of fluoride in water. So we want to chat with her a little bit about that. This day in medicine, June 7th, 1870, Dr. Max Brodel was born. Dr. Brodel was the founder of the art of medical illustration in the United States. He's a German-born physician trained in Germany and then emigrated to the United States and spent the rest of his career at Johns Hopkins University. And in the 1890s, when he came here, he was specifically recruited to come here to illustrate the work of great surgeons like Harvey Cushing. So he would go into the OR, observe surgery, and then provide these illustrations. Now, many of us are familiar, and it comes back to Connecticut, is one of the great illustrators of our time in medicine is Dr. Frank Netter. Dr. Netter published back then for the drug company, it was known as Seba Geigy. These wonderful volumes of medical illustration that really every medical student of my era used. And it comes back to Connecticut because the medical school at Quinnipiac University is named after Dr. Frank Netter. So again, we remember Dr. Brodel today. I want to get back to what's going on in healthcare. You know, one of our objectives on this show is obviously to keep people healthy. And part of that is learning how to defend yourself against illness. And it's become relevant for us. I mean, this show's been on 15 years, and never have we found our mission more relevant than now. And because we're now faced, I was trying to think of the right word, and the best word I can come up with, we're faced with a healthcare apocalypse. We're looking at a catastrophe in this country today, based on the policies being forced down our throat by an administration that really doesn't know what they're doing when it comes to health care. We're facing infectious diseases. We've seen a drop in public health officials, and really nothing's being done to keep us safe. Everything's being done with the idea to cut costs. And this has all become obvious in the first months of this current administration. So what we're going to be doing is looking at some of the policies that have come forward and how they're going to affect us. So the first one is with respect to global health. The Doge people, and that being Elon Musk and the president, the first thing they decided was to liquidate, basically, the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. They took thousands of employees and reduced them to a small number of about 15. and canceled millions of dollars in grants. These grants really affected things like nutrition, HIV, environmental situations in countries, and pandemic preparedness. But let's talk a little bit about USAID. My personal contact with USAID was in Haiti. And as many of you know, I work with Dr. and Father Rick Frechette. And USAID was an important part of the mission in Haiti. And unfortunately, it's not the case anymore. Specifically with respect to food distribution and distribution of medication. Nothing is more important medicine than food and nutrition. And right now, we're faced because children are dying without medical care and without nutrition in the world. We're faced with a situation that Bill Gates said, I think he put it best, the world's richest man is killing the world's poorest children. And that's what's going on outside of our borders. Now, many people are going to say, well, let other countries step up. But that what we're saying is we're abdicating our role of being the superhero for the world, right? Everybody loves these superheroes, Marvel superheroes. The United States has always been the superhero of the world. When flour got delivered, rice was delivered in Haiti, there was an American flag on that big bag of rice. And people noticed that, and they knew who was feeding them. Now, one of the things, you know, I was brought up, and I think a lot of people on this call and listening to this show right now probably were brought up with parents who lived through the Depression. Actually, there may be some listeners here who actually did live through the Depression in the 1930s, right? And people who grew up during the Depression had a certain philosophy, and that was you don't waste anything, right? I mean, you know what I'm talking about. You never wasted food, right? And especially when it came to food. That was like the cardinal sin. That was mortal sin. And that's what's going on now, right? We have food and medication in storage areas in Haiti, controlled by USAID, but we fired the people who distribute that food to hungry people. The same thing is going on in sub-Saharan Africa, in Sudan. People are starving. There's food there that we bought, we purchased, we spent this money already, and it's not being distributed. Is there a greater sin in the world than to watch someone die and you have food sitting there and withholding it from them because you want to cut some money from a budget? There's plenty of places to cut money. Don't get me wrong. There's plenty of waste in government. There's plenty of waste in everything. Heck, we could find waste in our own households. But the question does, do I just get rid of everything? And, you know, it's the question of the surgical approach, right, versus just bombing the whole thing. And that's what's happened. This is the greatest waste. We're also dealing with a restructuring now of the Health and Human Services Department. It's being led by Robert F. Kennedy. And this restructuring has resulted in many employees being laid off. Restricted activities in public health is really important. People are not going into public health anymore in this country because we've cut their jobs. There are no jobs. People are being laid off. Now, these are the people, but let's try to boil it down. What I like to do is boil it down to where we are. And that is, think about it. The people who inspect our restaurants are being laid off, right? The people who inspect our wastewater or our drinking water are being laid off. The weather's getting warm now. People are going to public swimming pools. Who's testing the water, right? We've always relied on those services. Those are done by people who are actively employed in public health. All this while our life expectancy goes down. Right? We're dealing with measles, pertussis, COVID. We've got the Make America Healthy Again policy. We talked about that last week on the show. Right? The MAHA movement, where they published a 72-page report that was subsequently found to be AI-generated because it had non-existing references, right? They referenced material to take their position that doesn't exist, or they quoted inaccurately. It outlined a lot of problems, but didn't give us one solution. And now we're going after Medicaid and Medicare, the things that, again, affect all of us, right? That's how many people get their care. Who is taking care of those Americans who cannot afford health care? Not that they're not working. These people work, but they're doing jobs that don't generate enough income for them to be able to go out and buy insurance. So we need to really look at this. The solutions are, first of all, with respect to public health and global health, we need to not let up on our elected officials to get this straight. Somebody has got to take care of it because it is a catastrophe. And I'll leave you with this thought. We talked about this several times on our show. There are only three things that will lead to the end of humanity as we know it. First, nuclear war. Second, infection, pestilence. Right? And third, climate. A change in the climate where we can't breathe air anymore. Those three things will end humanity. Are we even addressing those three basic things? Well, we've ignored two of them with this current administration. With that, we're going to take a short break. And then we're going to be back to talk to Dr. Xuan Lin about the use of fluoride in water. I wanted to know, where did this all come from? Why did we ever start using fluoride in water? What does it do for our health and our teeth? And how can we deal with this in areas where they have now decided to take fluoride out of the water? What are those people going to do in states like Florida and Utah in order to maintain good dental care? You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and we're going to play a taped interview that I did this week with Dr. Xuan Lin. She is a doctor of medical dentistry and an assistant clinical professor of dentistry at the University of Connecticut. And I want to get to the source, right? We're hearing all about fluoride in water. What are the risks? What are the benefits? That's basically what the decision comes down to. Not the public relations, not all the other stuff about it causing this problem or that problem. What we really need to do is get to science and get to the crux of the problem. Is there a problem or not? So with that, Kevin's going to roll that interview, and then we'll be back to wrap it up.
Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. Today, it gives me great pleasure to have with me Dr. Xuan Lin. Dr. Lin is an assistant clinical professor of dentistry at the University of Connecticut, and she's agreed to spend some time with us today. Welcome, Dr. Lin.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's talk a little bit about, the topic I wanted to talk about was fluoride. We're hearing a lot about communities who are now taking fluoride out of the water supply, but I wanted to take a step back. Why did we ever start putting fluoride into water?
So it's about back in the 50 years ago or something. They found out a group of villages or towns, they have very low cavity rates compared with the adjacent towns. And then they try to figure out what happened. They found that those towns had low cavity rates because their well water has a lot more fluoride. And then that make their teeth a lot harder, so they have a lower cavity rate. And that's when the dentist started thinking about why not just putting fluoride in the water to help people to have low cavity rate.
So it's one of those things that they actually found by accident.
Yes.
That was naturally occurring in water.
Yes.
So how did they know? In other words, they looked at just the rate of cavities and tooth decay. So it sounds like the perfect experiment without doing one. You've
yes.
looked at a group that have had fluoride mm-hmm. and then looked at a group that didn't have fluoride and determined that the fluoride made your teeth better. In what way does it help teeth?
So the fluoride, how it works is the fluoride will bond to the outside layer of your tooth and then make it very hard. And then when you have a lot of acid in your mouth, it doesn't dissolve your teeth as fast as normal will be. So make your teeth a lot harder than your regular outside layer of your tooth.
So how did they determine how much fluoride to put in?
I think ADA do a very thorough experiment to find out they use the lowest amount they can do to have the same effect. So they do very diligent studies in ADA, American Dental Association. They do a lot of those studies. So they use the lowest amount in the drinking water to help make the outside tooth, the layer to be hardened.
So over the course of the past 50 years, obviously we have good data from that standpoint. But what's the data? What's the downside of putting fluoride in the water?
The only thing is when you overdose it, it means that you have to drink a lot of the fluoridated water to might have some neurological effect, but it's not really significant.
Yeah. So the studies, actually, a lot of people are quoting the studies done in Europe that were a situational, observational study. But they had almost twice the amount of fluoride. So the amount is minimal now. We've cut that back.
Yes, we do.
Can you tell can dentists tell overall people who have had fluoride in their water or not? For example, like well water may not have fluoride, right? Do mm-hmm. they add fluoride or?
Normally, if we find out their well water has no fluoride, we'll recommend you to use fluoride toothpaste. And every 6 months when they come to the dental office, we'll apply the fluoride varnish on their teeth.
So that's an interesting question. So applying the fluoride varnish can substitute for having fluoride in the water?
I think because the concentration was thick enough for one dose, it have a fact that can, because your body will absorb it and then release in the saliva again, so it's kind of a continuous effect a little bit.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. That's very interesting because I never really thought of that. So there is an alternative for people who are living in Florida now where they're not putting fluoride in the water. It'll be an extra expense, obviously, mm-hmm. to have the fluoride treatments, but you can have your children treated with the fluoride safely.
Yes, and then we do that all the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thanks for coming on and explaining this to us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Once again, that was Dr. Xuan Lin, and I think it just sums it up. I mean, so if you're wealthy and you could afford it, you'll get the appropriate fluoride care be able to maintain good dentistry and good health overall, because we know that dental care is crucial to our overall health. We're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. If you want to reach out with questions for Dr. Ratchford, you can do that by emailing me live at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you once again on this Saturday morning. And my guest today is Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. Dr. Ratchford is the principal at the Ratchford Eye Center. And she has been a huge supporter of our program right from the beginning. And we have enjoyed her knowledge and been able to share her knowledge periodically over the years. So it's great to have her back again. Mary Gina, welcome back.
Thank you, Dr. Lessi. It's great to be here.
All right, let's jump right into it here. We are being bombarded on TV, on ads, and the idea of being told a lot about the dry eye syndrome, and almost to the point where you think it's like at epidemic proportions here. What is the dry eye syndrome that everybody's trying to resolve here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So dry eye is a multifactorial condition that can lead to many symptoms in the eye. There are three layers to the tear film. There's an watery layer that comes from the lacrimal gland. There's a oily layer that comes from meibomian glands. And then there's a mucousy layer that can become important in seasonal allergies. But whenever there's a disruption of that balance, it can lead to symptoms. The more common ones that we see today because of our screen time, and this can be anywhere from school kids up to, you know, older adults, when we look at a screen, our blink rate goes down, and it can lead to evaporation of the tears, which can then lead to blurred vision, fluctuating vision, and just feeling like that vision is filmy. The sister condition that goes along with that is the meibomian gland dysfunction that can sort of be a part of this dry eye syndrome. Mostly they go hand in hand. I have a lot of patients who have both the aqueous, decreased aqueous production and increased evaporation, but also have this meibomian gland dysfunction. Now, the purpose of the meibomian glands are to secrete meibom, which is an oil, and that can help protect evaporation, protect from environmental irritants. But when the oil glands become thick, you can see sort of redness around it, they become inflamed. People have increased risk of something called blepharitis or styes, otherwise known as chalazia. But every time you blink, a little aliquot of that oil comes out. And again, if there's too much oil and not enough water, it leads to, you know, a variety of symptoms. Sometimes it's gritty. Sometimes you feel like something's in the eye. Sometimes it's fluctuation. And sometimes if the corneal nerve endings get so exposed, it can be a very painful condition. Now, to your point, there's a lot of ads out there. I mean, they're on TV. We've got reps coming to our office about all the new players out there for dry eye therapy. Most of the time we start with over-the-counter medications, which can replace more of that aqueous component. There are some that are more lipid-based that can address the meibomian gland dysfunction. And those we have to dose once up to four times a day. If I have a patient who used those drops, you know, faithfully four times a day and are not getting better, then I have to really dissect, well, what's going on with their tear film? Is it an aqueous dysfunction or is it more meibomian gland dysfunction? And often, you know, there's a lot of overlap. So the drops out there for that aqueous insufficiency are things like Restasis, Cyclosporin, Xiidra, Cequa, Vevi. Those are the main players out there when we need to put someone on prescription strength. And then the new kid on the block is this drop called Meibo, which can affect that meibomian gland dysfunction and prevent evaporation of the tears. So when a person comes in complaining of blurred vision or, quote, dry eye, we really have to be a little more scientific in how we analyze the tear film and then, you know, kind of appropriately target what is the underlying condition.
Well, a couple of things that you brought up that I wanted to go back to. First of all, I didn't know that you blink less when you're looking at screen time. Is that a reflex that inhibits a reflex of blinking?
Exactly, yeah, because I think when you focus so much, your blink rate goes down. And, you know, there are some, and as you would know, this neurologic conditions that decrease tear film, Parkinson's being the big one. You know, if I have someone that comes in with a lot of exposure, I know that their neurologic input is not healthy. But it is a reflex when you're looking at the screen time that your blink rate goes down or not a complete blink. And that's why, you know, one of the first things we do is that, quote, 20-20-20 rule for after 20 minutes look away, you know, and take a good blink for 20 seconds and then, you know, kind of come back to your reading. So that can also revive that tear, kind of reestablish a balance, because every time you blink, you squeegee out the old tear and you generate a new one. So sometimes we do kind of have people think about that, you know, if you're reading a book at the end of a chapter, or if you're reading an article, or if you're working, just kind of make a habit of looking at the clock and say, just take a blink, look out the window, and then come back to your work.
You know, I never thought you would have to think about blinking, but
I know, right? yeah, it is crazy.
So if someone's experiencing this, is it simply the fact that their eyes are painful when they blink, or can you see visual loss associated with this? Now, I bring this up because I had a patient this week who was having some visual obscurations, and she actually said that when I look away from the screen and close my eyes for 10 or 20 seconds, she said everything goes away. So can you have visual changes with dry eye?
You can, and there's a spectrum of findings. So if you've got that tear film imbalance where there's a little bit too much oil, you are going to get sort of filmy or blurred vision. Now, in a more serious case of dry eye, and we see those in folks that have a systemic condition such as Sjogren's syndrome, we mentioned Parkinson's, any autoimmune type conditions, sometimes certain medications, you can get evaporation of the tears so that you develop a keratitis. So then the nerve endings are exposed in the cornea and it can become very painful. And if that goes untreated, you can develop, kind of surface scarring, and then that could lead to more permanent vision loss. I mean, there are some nutritional, like vitamin A is important for the tear film. So those with severe malnutrition, we can see those really types of, cornea scarring. But it takes a lot to get to permanent vision loss with dry eye because you get the secondary scarring of the cornea. So it definitely can be, a significant loss. Like I've had patients who, can see 20/70 on the chart, which is not clear, and we treat their dry eye and they come back and they can see 20/30 again, because that is really the first, layer that the light has to focus to get into the back of the eye. So you definitely can get some blurred vision, but again, more advanced cases can lead to more permanent vision loss.
Since we're on the subject of looking at computer screens, Susan had a question that came in, and that was regarding the use of computer screens. Is using a computer screen for an extended period of time causing damage to the eye? And with that, she also mentioned, is it worth investing in buying these blue-tinted lenses when you're looking at a computer screen?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's no scientific data that looking at a screen is going to cause permanent damage to your eyes, the retina, the lens. When we look at a screen, it does emit blue light. So putting those blue light filters can filter that out. And it can, when you have too much blue light, what it can do is it can throw off your sleep-wake cycle, especially if you're at night and you can't sleep or you relax to kind of scroll through Facebook or whatnot, and your arousal centers get triggered and then you can't go to sleep. So the blue light can potentially help that. There are like the night modes on your phones which can do that. And I do think that there's a lot of people who do, like those blue light filters, but it doesn't prevent damage. But some people do feel it does reduce the eye strain and get rid of headaches. But that really is a conjunction with treating, the dry eye that comes along with that computer vision syndrome. So I wouldn't necessarily say blue light is going to fix all computer vision syndrome, because there is a component of dry eye that goes along with it.
Once again, I never heard of computer vision syndrome. So,
Yeah, it's a thing.
It's a thing. Okay.
It's a thing, yeah.
One of the questions I always get is about floaters, and patients ask about floaters, and I get them. I think most people get them. Is it something we see more as we get older, and is there anything to do about them?
Yeah, for sure. So when we look at the anatomy of the eye, we got the focusing structures in the front, the cornea, the lens, and then the retina and the optic nerve in the back. But what the light has to pass through is a gel. It's called vitreous gel. And when we're young, the gel is like a raw egg white. So you can see it, but it's got some structure to it. And as we get older, that gel becomes more liquid and those protein strands become more mobile in the eye. Now, the other component of the vitreous is it's sticky. So as it separates from the retina, we do worry about it pulling the retina. So for someone who has a thinner retina, that gel, when it naturally separates, can tear the retina, and that's called a retinal tear or retinal detachment. Symptoms of a retinal detachment are a whole shower typically of flashes of light followed by a whole shower of floaters. So if all of a sudden you see like a bunch of bugs or smoke, or it looks like, you know, somebody, you know, threw pepper, that wouldn't be a symptom of just a garden variety floater. That would require you to call your eye provider and make sure the retina's okay. We also can see that in someone who's got diabetes, where that can represent blood. Definitely floaters are more common as you get older because that gel begins to become liquid. Most of the time people learn to ignore it. So, like, for example, if we're talking and the music's on, you can, you know, kind of disregard the music as we're paying attention to the conversation. But when we stop talking, you can hear the music again. So your brain kind of filters out that noise in the visual pathways. In very rare circumstances, I've got folks who are disabled by those dense floaters, and we can do what's called a vitrectomy, which is to take out the gel with a procedure to get rid of floaters. But that is not a common procedure, and we really don't do that to everybody who has floaters because there are risks to anything that we do.
I wanted to go to the next one, and that's something that we're seeing more and more of as the environment changes, and that's sun damage to the eye.
Right,
and,
that is correct,
you know,
yeah.
When we were younger, wearing sunglasses wasn't very common, actually. Now it's become really not only a fashion statement, but a standard necessity on really bright days. Can you talk a little bit about damage from sun, and how often are we seeing this? Are you seeing more of it over time?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think I'd like to point out, though, I mean, there are some healthy benefits from the sun, as you know. You know, we do need vitamin D. It does help with our sleep-wake cycle. And there is an epidemic in children now who don't get enough sun of myopia, where, you know, they're sitting on the screens, and so their eyes actually elongate almost pathologically. So I think there is some benefit from getting outside, you know, being outdoors, looking in the horizon. However, there is that damage potentially from ultraviolet rays. And even on a cloudy day, you know, there's still those ultraviolet lights penetrating and getting into your eye. So we do like, you know, sunglasses, a broad-rimmed hat when you're outside, especially now people are gardening. The sunglasses can protect not only your eyes, but also the skin around your eyes. So, you know, the worst sort of problem with looking directly at the sun, that can cause a solar retinopathy, and that's actually a burn to your retina. And, you know, I don't tend to see that except when people are looking at the eclipse or, you know, some kind of solar event. But I think hopefully, you know, it's common knowledge that you don't want to look directly at the sun. So I don't see a whole lot of solar retinopathy. However, we can see photokeratitis, which is inflammation of the cornea. We can see that like from reflection of the snow, the light against the snow, like we see it in welders, for example. So you can see that photokeratitis. Increased exposure to ultraviolet rays can also increase the rate of cataract growth, and it can be a contributing factor in macular degeneration over your lifetime. The other thing we can see with sun exposure are those little white spots on the conjunctiva called a pinguecula, which is an elevation, or a pterygium, which you see that kind of skin that grows over the cornea. And those are all triggered by ultraviolet rays. So for that, we do recommend sunglasses, 100% ultraviolet A and B protection. It doesn't have to be darker. Darker isn't necessarily better. The color almost doesn't matter, but it has to have the 100% A and B filtration. Polarized lenses are also good for the optics. It can reduce glare. So those are what we recommend for sunglasses. And actually, a little bit of a bigger frame I do prefer, because it can protect the skin around the eyes from, you know, skin cancer, you know, basal cell being a common one around the eye, squamous cell, and even a melanoma. And we can see choroidal melanomas, which is a cancer in the eye. So especially if you've got a family history, light skin, light blue eyes, we really do recommend, you know, wearing sunglasses, even if it's on a cloudy day.
And that's what I was going to ask you. How do you know when to wear sunglasses and when not to wear sunglasses? Is there a certain level of irritation, or some people are not bothered by the sun very much, but nevertheless, I'm sure they're having sun damage. So how do you know when
right.
it's appropriate? Like today we have a pretty cloudy day, a hazy day. Would it be appropriate right. to wear sunglasses or not?
You know, I think it would, again, because the clouds don't filter that ultraviolet radiation. You know, it does come through that. You know, you're not going to be so symptomatic because it's not super bright. But I think, you know, getting in the car, putting your sunglasses on should be a habit, especially if you're going outside for a walk, you should wear them. So I really think that you should err more on the side of wearing them versus not. And even in the winter, you know, especially that reflected light against the snow, you know, wearing the sunglasses is going to be important.
One of the questions that came up a few weeks ago from a listener, Bob, sent one over, and that was regarding shingles and viral infections of the eye. I know we've talked about it in the past, but can we talk a little bit about the effects of, you know, herpes zoster and its effect on the eye?
Yeah. So, you know, herpes zoster is a subtype of the herpes family. It's the chicken pox virus that we probably all were exposed to as kids that lives dormant in a nerve root. And then at some point in your life, it can become reactivated. There are three branches sort of in the trigeminal nerve in the face. So when we get one of those, it can affect the eye. And I've seen, you know, some milder cases of herpes zoster where the vesicles are around the eyebrow, on the eyelid, and at the very least, they're painful. But what can happen if that's not addressed early is you can end up with eye injury and damage, and that can be either corneal irritation or worse, a uveitis, which is a chronic inflammation of the tissues inside the eye. And that can cause all kinds of secondary troubles, cornea scarring, uncontrolled glaucoma, uncontrolled inflammation that requires chronic steroid use, pain, and sometimes loss of vision. So I get very, you know, really have to watch anyone that has those vesicles around the eyebrow, particularly if it's on your nose. That can be the same common nerve that can affect the cornea. And anything that we can do to avoid this. You know, I was at a conference and one of the speakers was one who had really pioneered some of the work in, you know, ocular herpes zoster. And, you know, ironically enough, she developed that in her eye and she had to stop operating because she lost so much vision that she lost her depth perception. So, you know, I would encourage anybody, you know, if you can get the shingles vaccine, it really, even if it's to avoid potential blindness, I mean, it can definitely be a serious problem. Not in everybody, but it has the potential to do that.
Absolutely. And I think some people, you know, even if you get shingles, if you've had the vaccine, you know, the time and the symptoms are much more limited. So
right,
it's important.
Right.
I had another question that came in from Joanne, sure. And I just wanted to touch on it. The difference between lazy eye and crossed eyes, amblyopia versus strabismus, I guess. What is the difference, and why is it that some people can have corrective surgeries and others cannot?
Right. So when we're born, our eyes kind of collect information from the world. And what has to happen is that those visual pathways have to develop neurologically. The brain has to get that important and correct information for it to develop properly. So if the eyes are misaligned when you're young, or if the power of the eyes are different, then both eyes won't develop normally. If they're the first initial problem is a crossed eye, whether it's a muscle imbalance, we can generally correct that in kids even as young as 3 months old so that the visual pathways that the brain receives can allow appropriate neurologic development. If that isn't caught before age 8 or 9, then sometimes those visual pathways mature and we can't correct that. So there can be a crossed eyes that leads to abnormal input that can be corrected early. Otherwise, if it's a refractive, meaning the eyes are different powers, then sometimes we put kids in glasses. We can cover the good eye so that the brain gets the proper development from the non-good eye to go forward. Now, it's different in adults. Sometimes adults can develop a what's called a decompensated lazy eye. So for their life, they were able to control it, and now as they're older, they can't. Those folks can be amenable to surgery to straighten out their eyes. But once those neural pathways develop, it almost doesn't matter what we do, glasses, surgery, that eye will not ever be as good as the other eye. And that's what we, quote, call a lazy eye. And that's more the amblyopia as opposed to strabismus, which is really a muscle imbalance.
Mary Gina, what's the next thing? And we got about a minute or two left here. What's the next thing we're going to hear more and more about in your field, in ophthalmology? Is it new surgeries, new medications? What can you tell us about what's coming down the pike?
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's a lot of research going on in sort of a lot of the more major conditions that we treat. I think the big innovations is in macular degeneration where, you know, for our patients who are having to go every 4 to 6 weeks for those injections to help reduce the bleeding and the swelling, we're trying to get different ways to extend the time in between visits to make those treatments more precise and to last a little bit longer. I think there's even going to be gene therapy that we can do for macular degeneration someday. In fact, we're doing some clinical trials where we can insert genetic material underneath the retina to see if we can, you know, at least slow down that process of macular degeneration. So I think that's a big area of research that I think even in, you know, our lifetime will be different. There are new ways to treat glaucoma. Also, there's a lot of what we call MIGS or micro-invasive glaucoma surgery. And again, it's about the delivery of care. So we now have something called iDose where we can inject a small pellet of medication that then releases that medication over a 2 to 3 year period. So again, trying to control the disease earlier, maybe not rely on people taking eye drops all the time to help control their glaucoma. So that's there's a new kind of device or improvement of device, you know, almost every 6 months where we have something new to try. There are new lenses coming out to correct, you know, after cataract surgery. One of the newer technologies is something called a light adjustable lens that we can put in the eye and adjust it after it's been in the patient to change the power once it's in the eye. So that's kind of newer, new technology that's kind of coming into our area. And then again, in sort of this dry eye therapy, there's again, new ways. Once we understand the underlying condition, we can be more targeted in our routine. And I think there's going to be a role for immunotherapy in some of the more systemic conditions that are coming through. So that's kind of a very basic overview, but there's always something exciting to learn about.
It sounds very exciting, and I thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for support of our program. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Ratchford, you could reach her at 860-829-8939, and she is at the Ratchford Eye Center on Farmington Avenue in Berlin, Connecticut. Mary Gina, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you so much. I always enjoy it, and it's a great program. Keep going. Thanks, Dr. Lessie.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you have any questions during the week, you could reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. I appreciate all the questions that came in for Dr. Ratchford. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Ratchford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.